Conference record has joined the conference.
Okay, let's begin. Let's go forward with the licensed professional subgroup reports, proposals, and are there folks on the call-in line?
Yes, hi, it's Lauren Johnston.
Oh, hi.
I'm Karen.
Anyone else? I apologize if we lost some people with the timing and the food, but we're kind of reconvening now.
Labor's here.
Okay, good. Okay, so I don't know whether this will be lively or whether this will be boring and people will start falling asleep after lunch. We have quite a few proposals to go through. You know, so I think, again, just keeping a sense of the context and the quorum of how we want to do this. And as I said, to me, these proposals are almost more for the people who weren't in the subgroup where we've had a lively discussion. Not to say that I don't mean to cut off conversation, but just, you know, we want to be mindful of the time and so on, and especially, again, you know, any input from those who, well, this may be a first telling for those. I picked an order somewhat with some rhyme or reason. I won't go into all the reason why, but I thought we'd start off with, maybe you could, some of you might guess, Fred, number 38, would you like to start with that proposal?
Sure, Bill, thank you very much. Hope everybody survived lunch.
And does everyone have a copy of that?
We just passed it out.
Okay,
just
great.
Around. Yep. This proposal number 38 is based on the fact that in many areas of the state, particularly rural and underserved areas, it's more and more becoming common that to retain physicians in the community or attract them, Article 28 entities need to hire them. And some of these physicians who have practices within the community who get hired by Article 28 facilities would like to continue to follow the patients they had in their private practice, particularly the homebound, disabled-type patients who aren't mobile enough to come into a hospital clinic or something like that. And what we're proposing here is that the physician home visit with the physician being employed by an Article 28 facility be enabled by the state. There is an existing model that exists for federally qualified health centers. FQHCs are licensed as a type of diagnostic and treatment center, and from our perspective, we're asking that the authority and ability to conduct physician home visits be extended to other Article 28 providers.
Okay, thank you. Any comments or questions? Would you speak to the microphone and make sure that the microphone's on?
Dental home visits from Article 28. It's just, I know it's not something that's going to move forward, but it's absolutely something we should think about in the future.
So what's your comment?
Adding dental services that are out of Article 28 facilities also being paid for home visits.
Okay, is that something that you can integrate, or is that a separate thing?
I have no objection to it. I just don't know how that works in FQHCs.
Okay, maybe if you can convey.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
No.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, Karen would know.
I don't believe that FQHCs get reimbursed for that.
Okay. All right. Joy.
So,
I'm sorry.
What item?
This is number 38.
38.
And there should be a proposal around the table. Joyce.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to speak in support of this. It is provider neutral, and the only thing I would ask is that you redact the term mid-level practitioner. That's not what we are. If you would be kind enough and accurate enough to say that we are nurse practitioners, midwives, physician's assistants, that would be appropriate. Thank you.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. Any other comments?
More questions?
Questions, yes.
This is primarily a reimbursement issue, right? It's not a scope of practice issue.
It's not scope of practice.
I know that we have a very comparable issue with our clinics in terms of being able to deliver off-site. In fact, that's been set up on with spot. We'd be more very supportive, empathetic even.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's not scope of practice. It's both reimbursement and authority, though. Because remember, the patient's home is not an approved Article 28 location.
Exactly.
Yes.
I'd like to speak in favor of this and also raise several practical concerns about it. One is from the perspective of the long-term care setting and from the perspective of the long-term care setting at home, I think there's an obligation for a physician who wants to have the ability to treat patients in all settings to accept the responsibility of doing it regardless of the safety of the neighborhood, so that for physicians to be able to pick and choose isn't going to necessarily be to anyone's advantage. And secondarily, I think that if the physician wants the ability to treat patients in the nursing home, they need to agree to comply with the regulations so that indeed they make the 30-day visits, and when the patient needs an urgent visit, they also come and do it, so that it serves the patients and serves all the patients.
Well, you know, certainly they would have to comply with regulations. There's no argument there. But this, you know, this really is an option. You know, it's not a requirement that patients be seen in their home. It's to provide the availability of the, you know, the authority to do so.
I think that the only piece, though, is that if someone wants to take advantage of that authority, there's also responsibilities which come along with it.
Oh, absolutely. Towards the patient.
Towards the patient.
Yes.
Yeah.
No argument there, yeah.
Yes, we actually, on the mental health side with our clinics, we've actually moved in that direction and created authority for our clinics to provide off-site services.
Is that Article 31?
Yeah, Article 31 clinics, and you might want to look at that.
Yeah, good, thank you.
But I just warn you that one of the things that, and we've dealt with all of the issues that have raised about, you know, ensuring accountability and so on, and the concern about it being off-site. But it may be more than simply a regulatory issue. In our case, it's a problem with the SPA. The state plan amendment needs to be Medicaid as well, which is the primary driver of reimbursement in our system. So that may, in fact, be an issue as well.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I wasn't clear on that, so.
Okay, any other comments? Great, thank you. And Fred, how about, since you're so good at this, how about number 39?
Well, thank you again, Bill. What we're proposing in 39, which is very similar to 44, so we've combined them, is that that standing orders can be used in hospitals in New York State, and that it be, that the practice be legitimized. We're basing our proposal on two things, really. One is the proposed changes to conditions of participation by the Medicare program, by CMS, that were just announced recently, which we fully expect to see enacted because it's a result of a several-year study they've undertaken since 2008, and frankly, to recognize existing practice to some degree. And we're looking at it from the standpoint of improving the quality of care so that for certain circumstances, they'd be defined circumstances, particularly in the emergency room, treatment can be immediate upon arrival at the emergency department. Doesn't necessarily have to await a practitioner who has ordering authority. There would be protocols set forth for the types of patients treated. It would be defined by the hospital's medical staff. Ultimately, all orders would be signed by ordering practitioners. It'll all be laid out pretty much in federal rules anyway. And we're asking that the same thing apply to New York once it becomes a national standard.
Any questions, comments?
Hi, it's Lauren Johnson, and clearly I'm number 44, so I'm fully in support of this, and I can tell you that every chief nurse that I've spoken to in the area just can't wait. The only concern I have, of course, is this has been a limitation of her scope of practice with the Department of Education, so will this recommendation be able to be acted upon?
Did you hear?
I only heard the will this recommendation be acted upon part, but
I think if I'm very supportive question about state education department's role in enacting this.
Well, the state education is a key role.
Yes.
In enacting this.
So I mean I guess that's to be determined. And,
yes. Yeah.
And that's,
they're not here.
They're not here today, and as well as so again, these are another examples of just because we have a recommendation doesn't mean that it's done. Or even, you know, if it's approved by the MRT, it's not done. We have, you know, and that's why in each of the proposals, we're, you know, we have to, like, what else is required. So we know there's still ways to go with this, and state ed, education department is going to be key to quite a few. So
yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And this is one of them, clearly.
This is one of them, yeah.
Fred, under sector here, it indicates acute care, long-term care, et cetera, with acute. I'm wondering if it might also apply to ambulatory care settings in those providing primary care.
Certainly from my perspective, it certainly could fit. I'm not sure at the federal level how broad it is, though, because we're suggesting modeling after what happens, excuse me, at the national level. If we have no objection of it applying to all Article 28 facilities. Bob.
I'm not sure I understand something, because we already have standing orders, at least in the facilities I practice in.
I know you do.
What's the difference? What change are you asking for?
We're asking for it to be legitimized. Because right now, if I don't want to paraphrase state ed's position, but state ed's position is that nurses don't have, maybe Tina, you could help me with this, nurses don't have the authority necessarily to diagnose, initiate treatment, and effectively carry out practice protocols, except we know they're used in hospitals all over the state today anyway.
Which is why in my facility, I think these are determined by the medical staff.
Yes, that's right. And that's what CMS is proposing as well. But that's not in place in New York State.
Design and implementation of the standing orders.
I'm sorry.
So physicians will be
absolutely
responsible for the design and implementation of the standing
and then have to sign off on it afterwards. Yes, that's the way CMS has designed it. But Tina, maybe you could.
Yeah, I think the issue is the issue of not having the protocol.
The issue from the state education department perspective. I don't want to speak for them, but we've had this conversation multiple times. The issue from the state education department's perspective is that the orders are not patient-specific.
Right.
And that is the issue related to the Nurse Practice Act. We're supposed to have patient-specific plans of care and patient-specific protocols. So I know one of the issues that we've debated with the state ed is if the person arrives with a diagnosis. I know asthma was one of the ones that was there, an acute asthma. If the patient has already been diagnosed with asthma, then I think the state education department can understand beginning a protocol because you already have a working diagnosis for someone. It's a chronic illness. You have a diagnosis. They present with an acute exacerbation, you follow a protocol. If somebody presented with shortness of breath and was having, quote unquote, an asthma attack, but they had not already been diagnosed with asthma, that's where they have an issue because
there's no diagnosis.
There's no diagnosis. And what specific patient, order would you be following? Who's making the diagnosis that this is an acute asthma attack and therefore following a protocol? That's their issue. I mean, but the question that I have for you, Fred, from what I heard you say, I just want to understand it, is that this would be initiated after the federal guidelines came out and that they would then be adopted in New York. You're not asking for something before that or supplemental to that, or are you?
We're asking what you described at first, that once the federal rules are changed, that they be adopted in New York.
So the federal rules would be adopted in New York?
Yes, correct.
Okay, yep.
Fred, correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't the federal rules give the state authority to follow?
I believe it's intended to enable the use of standing orders.
Right.
Yes.
So it removed the federal defense getting out of the way if the state wanted to do this. That's how I was reading.
Yes.
Right.
But it would require a change at the state level, too, to be enacted in New York. And that's what we're proposing. Bob?
Yeah, I just want to bring up the reality that the people can present to the emergency room with the history of asthma and having a cardiac event. So there should be standing orders have to be done wisely with appropriate physician evaluation at some point.
Yes.
Especially if we have an effective triage protocol, which many places do not, but if there was effective triage, standing orders have more value and are safer. But to just use them without appropriate evaluations can have their risk.
Yeah, this would be something, the way it's designed in the proposed federal rules, would be something that would really be under the auspices of the medical staff to design and oversee.
Okay.
Thank you. And that's what we're proposing. It, you know, it speaks to studies and evidence-based standards to show that this improves quality. You know, it makes the response more rapid. Another area that I didn't mention that deals with immunizations in general, and it's intended to encourage immunizations. And one area that we propose that would fit that category, I believe, is the mandatory newborn immunizations and treatments when they, you know, arrive at the nursery, that sort of thing, rather than have to wait for an order. It has to happen anyway, mandated by the state law. Why do you have to delay and wait till somebody comes and raise an order? So it's those sorts of things. And it clearly would be under the auspices of the medical staff. And we're not looking to expose any nurses to any liability either.
Okay, great. Any other comments? Thank you, Fred.
Thank you.
Let's move on to Tina. How about Title Protection 54? Did you pass them around?
No, I saw some of them. I wasn't sure. It looked like some things were copied and some weren't. So here's the first door.
Okay.
They're front and back.
We received these yesterday, right?
Yes, we did.
Thank you.
Which one do you want to do, Bill, first, 53 or 54?
I'm going to do that one and then go on to another one and come back.
Which one? I'm sorry.
54.
54, okay. 54 is the establishment of certification and title protection for clinical nurse specialists. Clinical nurse specialists are recognized in 38 other states. The real intent of this is that there are nurses practicing and using the title of clinical nurse specialist because they've received that title through their hospital or their agency, but they have not been educated and trained at the master's level. Recognition in Medicare and the federal government for clinical nurse specialists are master's prepared nurses in a specialty. So what we would like to do is have that same recognition put into regulation and statute here in New York State.
Great. Any questions, comments? Joy.
I would speak in support for the following reasons. It brings New York into line with 38 other states. It brings New York into line with recommendations from the federal government. It protects the public because the public needs to know that the person calling themselves, whatever title it is, in this case, a clinical nurse specialist, if the standard is a master's degree, that individual holds a master's degree. It is not appropriate for an agency or a hospital to call a person any kind of title with, if they have not been educated at that level.
Thank you. Bob.
I think this is exactly the kind of thing that would serve well in the scope of practice program that you talked about earlier today. And I think this is something that I would suggest be tabled and placed into that for future investigation.
Okay, well, we're not, you know, I think that at least the plan that as I understood it, these were proposals that we're going forward with in terms of at least being scored by the instrument and not going to the debate at this forum whether something should be proceeded to be recommended to the full MRT. So it doesn't mean that we can have a discussion about that, but, you know, I'm reluctant to do that because we can start doing that with every proposal, and that opens up, again, a very, very wide-ranging conversation. So it can be tabled at some point down the road, you know, once we see the scoring as an added bit of information. So that's how I would take that. Yes.
As I read it, it's a question of granting of a title recognizing somebody's enhanced training or education. It doesn't see, I don't think it changes anyone's scope of practice.
It does not.
Does it?
No.
It does not.
No.
It does not.
It's just right, title
yeah.
Protection.
This is really a question for Tina and Joy. Can you just speak to, I mean, I'm familiar, very familiar with the title and what I think is permissible you will, for nurse practitioner, nurse midwife, nurse anesthetist. I will say this title seems a little more vague, clinical nurse specialist. So can you just speak to a little bit more about what the clinical nurse specialist is, does, and what you want protected under that title?
Okay. there are several specialty areas that clinical nurse specialists are educated and trained in. Psychiatry, there's acute care. The difference is that they also have a lot of education in systems management and systems change so that they can help patients move more quickly through the healthcare delivery system. Besides having clinical knowledge in that area, they also have enhanced knowledge and experience with the healthcare delivery system. So, for example, getting somebody from acute care into home care, into long-term care or whatever, they kind of help navigate patients through the system so that they decrease length of stay. They can hopefully keep people out of the hospital into a lower level of care or into their home. So that's some of the education and training that they have that is a little bit different than the classic nurse practitioner, who is more focused on direct care. So it's a little combo of both of those things, but it's more for the system. They also can be educated in education so that they help with education of nurses as there's changes in technology or changes in hospital systems or whatever. They help educate the nurses and make sure that they're competent to provide that different care or different level of care depending on where they're working.
I have a question. So these clinical nurse specialists, these are individuals who graduate from our clinical nurse specialist programs,
correct?
Which are registered with New York State. CUNY has, I think, several. So these are individuals, and it's individuals who graduated under that particular registered program that you're talking about.
Right.
Is that right?
Part of the proposal is that their graduation would be recognized by the state so that they would be certified. So, that, again, if you wanted to protect, check, make sure that this person had gone through an appropriately accredited program and could use the protected title of clinical nurse specialist, they would be receive a certification from the state and then be able to present that no matter where they're working.
Joyce?
And Tim, you made mention of the term vague, and you are right. The role is vague, and that's New York State's fault, because New York State has avoided or neglected or just has not found the time to address a bill that would, in fact, carefully define their scope of practice. And I would just make one more comment about the benefit of their role in reducing costs. I mean, Tina has talked about helping to move patients through the healthcare system from emergency care to acute care to long-term care or rehab and back into home. That is what reduces costs, and it further prevents hospital readmission, reducing costs to the system.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Great. Thank you, Tina. Let's move on to David and physician assistants. And does everyone have a copy of the proposal? Were those passed out?
They were.
Okay, thanks.
So hopefully everybody has received this. It's number 45, removal of physician supervisory ratio. Essentially, this recommendation currently in place in New York State, there's a limitation that a physician can supervise two PAs in an office setting, four in a correctional, six in a hospital setting at one time. The recommendation being put forward is that those be eliminated or removed, and in its place that the supervision be determined at the practice site by the physician. Addressing a couple of the questions that I know we're supposed to answer about cost, physician assistants are reimbursed at a rate of 85% of the physician's rate, so there would be a cost savings involved. So far as supporting documentation that we were asked to provide, I put in a statement from the American College of Physicians encouraging flexibility in state and federal regulations so that each medical practice determines appropriate clinical roles within the medical team, physician-to-PA ratios and supervision processes enabling each clinician to work to the fullest extent of his or her license and expertise. The Federation of State Boards of Medicine also supports ratios being determined at the practice level in their 2010 Essentials of Modern Medical and Osteopathic Practice. Recommends that state laws simply require that no physician should have under their supervision more staff, physician assistant or otherwise, than the physician can adequately supervise. There was also a 1998 AMA documentation that the appropriate ratio of physician to physician extenders should be determined by physicians at the practice level, supervising physicians are the most knowledgeable of their own supervisory abilities and practice style, as well as the training and expertise of the PEs in their practice, rather than maximizing a physician's ability to direct patient care. The council believes the specific ratio of supervisory physicians to physician extenders might restrict appropriate provision of care and reduce access to care. Extending on this as far as Medicaid expectations and the care expectations, in rural counties and rural areas in the state where there may be only one physician providing primary care, this would enable that physician to provide supervision for additional providers if they felt comfortable with that.
Thanks, David. Any questions or comments? Bob.
Again, at the risk of rehashing yesterday's prolonged discussion, to me, this is sort of just asking for a free-for-all without any significant state oversight or supervision. We've already heard yesterday that there is a lot of gaps in the state's monitoring and supervising both collaborative and supervisory positions. And to throw it out, it really could subject to not just abuse by physicians, but certainly a very poorly regulated and difficult to regulate environment. Now, I live in an upstate area. I live and practice in Saratoga Springs. And there have been unintended consequences. We are a very mature marketplace with a high percentage of mid-level providers, physicians, and nurse practitioners. In our experience, that has resulted in a tremendous difficulty recruiting physicians into our area. Physicians, nurse practitioners, and PAs are paid the same by most providers in my region. I cannot speak for Medicaid, and we are focused here on Medicaid. And while Medicare is supposed to reimburse at 85%, the incidency modifiers are used routinely. But the insurers themselves, and I can specifically speak for the Blues, MVP, and CDPHP, have policies to reimburse at the same fee. So there really is no cost savings to this. But I can tell you that there are truly unintended consequences. Recruiting physicians in the upstate area has become very difficult. And if anything, I would suggest that we actually need to ramp up the monitoring of the supervisory and collaborative physician to make sure he is actually doing his responsible role. To loosen the numbers, I think it would open it up to a tremendous amount of fraud and abuse and also clearly affect quality because physicians can only monitor so many people. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments or questions?
I'll just add that so far this takes place in the state, and there are no numeric restrictions in the state of Alaska, Arkansas, Maine, North Carolina, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Tennessee, and Vermont. Any state that has relaxed, loosened, or eliminated the ratios has not gone back nor had complications that have been documented. And that's all the data I have.
Okay. Bob, again, trying to avoid
right.
We had the discussion yesterday in our subgroup, so I'm really interested in the others. But go ahead. Keep that in mind.
I just want to reiterate that up until now, there's been very little provider-specific data from insurers, as I referenced this morning, and I really think this is an excellent opportunity to study and research before we leap forward blindly.
Joy.
I'm going to respectfully speak in favor of this because this goes to our charge, which is and our mission, which is workforce flexibility. And I'm going to point to, in terms of outcome data, the 8 states in which this is already taking place. It appears to be a national trend. We have issues today in medically underserved areas and health care provider shortage areas in this state that this will help address. So I would speak in favor of that.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Tim?
Can I just clarify one thing that I think I heard? But David, you're saying that the American Medical Association and our own ACP at the New York State level is supportive of this? Right, American College of Physicians. Right, but we have a New York State group. Are you saying they're also supportive? Or do we not know? Okay. So the national AMA and ACP is supportive, but it sounds like NISNI is not. Okay.
I actually happen to just have the paper from the American College of Physicians, which I'd be more than happy to submit to the chair for this review, which doesn't exactly say what that is.
I mean, David, you were making quotes from it that tend to support that, but it's not the full report necessarily. Okay. Any other comments or questions on this one? Okay, great. So we'll put that through, and the next one I thought we'd try is, and Mary Ellen, we made it. You made it, Mary Ellen. So why don't you, Tom, did we lose you, Tom, or are you still on the line?
No, you've never lost me.
Oh, thank you so much. And again, I apologize to those on the line for a long break. But so I think we have a number of proposals in the world of dentistry, I guess you'd say. Mary Ellen, would you start with 16?
Sure, Bill. Let me start by saying that I think Chair's suggestion.
Would you speak right into the microphone and make sure it's on?
At the chair's suggestion, Tom and I had a mediated discussion last night, and I think we're both on pretty much the same page for most of the things, but please, Tom, you know, speak up if I get something wrong. We have gone from the number of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 proposals. Do you want to know this? You want me to just go right to 16?
16, 18, and
okay.
And 71.
71A. Mm-hmm.
71A, yeah.
16, Children's Dental Health.
I'm sorry, one thing. Do we have copies of your proposal?
Oh, I'm sorry. They're right here.
Yep. Sorry about that. Okay.
I'm here physically, but apparently my brain is not.
So 16 is going around first, and then, okay, great. So it's coming around, folks.
This is a proposal to amend Education Law Section 903-2A to include registered dental hygienists as an additional oral health provider able to perform the school readiness oral health examination by means of follow-up and case manage these children to enroll within a dental home. I'm not going to read this, but basically the law was passed in 2007, enacted in 2009, and there have been some issues with it. Some counties are working through the issues very well, as Tom noted yesterday in Chemung County. According to the New York State Technical Assistance Center in Rochester, there is approximately 20 counties across New York State with limited to no private practice dentists enrolled in the program. There are additional issues that deal with the consent form gathering and acceptance of the policy change by parents and school personnel. This proposal supports the goal of the work group's charge, which is to determine the potential flexibility of the current workforce. And we are hoping that increased numbers of providers will help to get more of these children into dental homes, which was Tom's big concern yesterday. Dental hygienists are out in the community working in school-based and portable dental programs and would offer one more avenue for additional assistance in making this policy change effective. And as part of their practice, I do wish to stress that dental hygienists who uncover any evidence of dental disease, dental caries or cavities, are bound ethically and professionally to case manage those patients into a dental home situation. And again, this might add to the effectiveness of the policy change. The impact on Medicaid costs would be limited, as the intent of these assessments was to provide them at free or reduced cost to the patient. And as far as Medicaid efficiency, it would truly allow more dentists to focus on restorative procedures while looking to hygienists to assess and refer for care. Implementation complexity is nearly non-existent. It would require a statutory change, and we would be able to put it into action as soon as it was enacted.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
What does it mean to case manage a patient into a dental home?
If we find children with dental decay, it's our professional and ethical responsibility to make sure we get that child into care, which is not always easy, but we don't leave them hanging.
And dental home means a
place that will accept them as a patient and treat their dental caries.
Bob.
Do you have a representative as a voice on this committee from the New York State Dental Association?
Excuse me?
Do we have someone from the Dental Association?
No, we don't.
Having voice in this discussion?
No, we don't.
I think that would really be critical. And again, I'll say, even though you said I can't, to table this into the research arm of our committee.
That's not the process we would be following. We do have, Tom Curran, who was, the New York State Dental Association isn't represented here. And, I think that, again, as we go forward, getting letters of support. But, Tom, is there something, can you speak to this at all?
Yes, I would, please. I don't represent the Dental Association.
Can you speak louder?
Yes, I have 25 years of experience in the Chemung County Board of Health, and I'm currently working with this program. It's only been functional for 2 years. Can you hear me, Bill?
No.
Yeah, just very.
I'll shout as much as I can.
That's a bit better. Okay.
My problem with this is that this bill has numerous problems, but one of them is not getting more hygienists involved. I'm not sure everybody is aware that currently the dentists and hygienists that are involved with school programs have to be from an Article 28. So they don't involve anybody from private practice, either dentist or hygienist. But the big problem is that this has to be a partnership between the public sector and the private sector, because the ultimate goal of this is not to fill out a form. The ultimate goal of this is to get patients who need care into a dental home, whether it's in Article 28 or it's in private practice. So I only wish that the problem with this law was lack of hygienists, but I certainly do understand Mary Ellen's concern about signing the sheet if the patient comes into an office. The hygienist usually sees the patient. It's the dentist who provides the care at free or reduced rate. But it's and maybe an answer to this is to have both of them sign the sheet. And that can be done, I think, without a statutory change. I think that could be a regulatory change. But I only wish that the problems with this law were lack of hygienists. The major problem with this law is that we cannot get patients, the parents or guardians' permission. We end up with, even in schools, with over three-quarters of the people on free and reduced lunch, with only getting 25% of or less of the parents the sign for us to be able to do the evaluation. And you have to understand, in the same grades, K2, 4, 7, and 10, 100% of the people are getting medical evaluation. So there are many defects here, and it needs attention. We're trying to work on this over a three-year program, but it needs to have private dentists involved with this in order to have the end point being treatment for these children that need it. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Bob.
Yeah, I would just like to strongly support the comments he made. Engaging the private practitioners in the community really has to be a goal for the Medicaid redesign. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll have to be coming back to all these things perhaps at the very end of our process. Mary Ellen, 18.
18. This proposal is to...
You're going to pass that out as well, Reggie.
Where's my secretary? I don't have one. This proposal is to amend Title VIII of Education Law, Section 6606, the definition of the practice of dental hygiene to allow for collaborative practice in dental hygiene, and a redefinition of the practice of the profession. I don't want to bore everyone with the dental crisis that we find ourselves in, not only here in New York State, but across the country. One thing, point I'd like to make is that dental caries continues to be the most prevalent childhood disease, surpassing asthma. 38.4% of Medicaid children in New York State accessed no dental services in 2009. Children visiting emergency rooms in New York State and ambulatory surgery facilities for the treatment of early childhood caries and pulpal involvement diseases reached 5,683 encounters, which was a far cry from the 1,500 encounters targeted. You know, this is, there are studies, basically, the disparities in oral health certainly follow racial, ethnic, and lower socioeconomic tracks. And we have all agreed that multiple clinical approaches are required to reduce the disparities. Dental hygiene practice with a redefinition will give us the ability to maximize what we do, and while it isn't going to cure all of the ills, it will focus us, hopefully the state of New York, on prevention of this disease rather than always trying to drill and fill our way out of the quagmire. Dental disease impacts every single chronic disease in one way or another. Persons with diabetes need preventive dental hygiene services if they're going to control their blood sugar levels. Pregnant women, persons with heart disease, there is new research to show there's a tie to pancreatic cancer, all of that. The benefits of the proposal are listed here for you. I don't know how much detail everyone wants. We'll just let everyone read this themselves. It is very specific about, in the actual legislation, very specific about the collaborative agreement with the dentist, and really lays out an opportunity for them to work collaboratively, both professions being able to maximize their profession. Sorry. One of the things we talked about was the savings that it would make. There is currently a pilot program going on in Virginia, and it is a remote teledentistry type of supervision of dental hygienists placing dental sealants. In the first year, they found that there was an overall saving of nearly $5 per sealant, and they had performed somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 sealants. So just for that one school program, which was less than 7 months, there was a savings of over $15,000 to Medicaid. Impact on quality care is improved. Preventive care will ultimately lead to improved health status. Medicaid costs should be lowered. Hopefully the dollars that are spent on registered dental hygienists in collaborative practice in public health arenas will be expended on prevention and eventually lower long-term costs.
Okay.
The change in statute will just allow the practice. It is not an expansion of anything. It is bringing the definition of the practice of dental hygiene in line with the current process of care, which is accepted by the Council on Dental Accreditation, the accrediting body for dental schools, dental hygiene schools, and dental assisting schools. It will eliminate a laundry list of tasks and go back to the process of care, which the laundry list is extremely restrictive and causes a problem every time there's a new technology. Collaborative practice, there are 27 states that allow direct access to dental hygienists by means of collaborative practice, public health dental hygiene practice, or unsupervised practice. And at this point, New York State is the only one in the New England, New York area that does not.
Okay, thank you. Tom, let me reach out to Tom, this is on the line, make sure. Tom, are you there?
These are the two recommendations that Mary Ellen and I couldn't, we had to agree to disagree.
What happened to that mediator you guys had? So, sorry, just a joke. I'm sorry, go ahead, Tom.
I hope everyone understands that I do not, I'm not speaking for the New York State Dental Association. I don't have any really, I'm not an officer, not on any committees. So this comes really from my own county, but our county not only has one of the three remaining county Article 28 dental clinics, but it is one of the 31 programs that has a sealant program in schools. And here again, you should understand that in relation to the sealant program, the hygienist works in the school under general supervision. That is to say, the dentist is at our clinic. And presently, no private dentist or private hygienist can go into the school under the sealant program. My big problem with this is that a couple of years ago that the hygienist and association and the dental association seemed to come to some type of agreement. At the 11th hour, that kind of fell apart. Since that period of time, they're at opposite sides. So not only does this need statutory approval, there is a difference of opinion on whether it really involves a change in scope of practice. I don't want to debate that. But the big problem that I have with this one is that, you know, I'm not so sure that this problem is going to be solved in this arena. I think it's going to be solved in Albany, in the legislature. And it's been a problem that's preceded this organization, and it's going to be after the workforce subcommittee is no longer making recommendations.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Any other comments or questions?
I have a question for Mary Ellen. Is there currently a bill that embodies this recommendation?
There is in the Assembly. We don't have a Senate sponsor. Amy Pollan, 00111.
I'm sorry, the number?
00111.
Okay. And I would just like to say, the fact that this is going to require action by the legislature doesn't argue against this body and the full MRT endorsing it, because I think having the endorsement of the MRT process will give it a lot more credibility with the legislature and may even get it put in as a program bill or part of the budget legislation by the governor, which would be very helpful.
Thank you. Yes, Joy.
I'm going to speak in favor of this for a couple of reasons. For the sake of expanding access, and, you know, maybe the dentists don't want to hear how I think this is going to help them, but if you had a collaborative practice agreement, right now the dentist has to be there all the time. The dentist could go to another site one or two days a week, and the hygienist could just have the office for hygiene that day. Expanding the practice, if you will, or the availability of the dentist into other areas. It's obviously going to lower cost. So it's really a very positive move, and I support this.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Could I say
Hold one second, if that's Tom. Tim, and then you, Tom.
Can I just clarify, is part of this, the way this would flow out, if you will, that the dental hygienist would be able to bill Medicaid directly?
Eventually, yes, or through the facility or community health center or wherever they were working for. I really don't anticipate direct.
Was you talking to the microphone?
Sorry. I don't anticipate a lot of direct billing. We anticipate a collaborative practice hygienist being employed more in the public health arena for facilities, nursing homes, community health centers, that type of thing. So, sure, I mean, the normal sequence, eventually we'll get to the point where there will be a situation where billing will be necessary, but we're just looking for the opportunity to go out and practice the profession without the supervision.
Right, so this doesn't automatically trigger that.
No. We don't have a bill in for that.
Okay, and I'm going to go back to you, Tom, but I just want to, again, we want to see, this isn't a forum for too much back and forth, but if you have something else to add, Tom, go ahead.
Very quickly, Joy brought up a point. At the present time, hygienists can work in relation to an Article 28 without a dentist being present and is working at another site. So that currently takes place right at the present time. I only can tell you that this is going to meet with a great deal of resistance by the group that's not represented here, which is the New York State Dental Association.
Okay, thank you. Okay, in the interest of time, maybe no more comments anyway. Tom, did you have a proposal? Was there a 71 or 71A that was mentioned about being coming up? And if do we have copies of that?
I haven't prepared the PIS just yet. We pretty much talked about this late last night.
Okay, so we're not going to go through that now because we need to have the proposal something to respond to. Well, as we were saying, there are some other proposals that didn't quite make it in here but are maybe a little bit around, and we're going to have to look at that on a case-by-case basis. We want to be as inclusive as we can, especially if it's been a little bit under discussion or so on. So I think if we don't have a proposal to look at, we don't really want to get into it now.
We have a proposal wording, but we don't have the rest.
You don't have what?
We have the proposal wording, but we do not have the PIS completed yet.
Yeah, so I think we'll have to hold off on that just in the interest of time and this body here.
Okay.
If that's all right, if that's okay. Okay, Joy, you're on for 46, 47?
47, which... really combined,
yes.
And I passed that out earlier.
Yes.
So I'm not going to bore you with reading it to you because I know you can all do that, and I hope you can hear me. What I'm going to do is address what the proposal will do. And the proposal is to eliminate from the Nurse Practice Act for nurse practitioners the collaborative practice agreement requirements. And what will this do? The name of the numbers of the bills are A, 5308 and S3289. And the bill is going to accomplish the following goals. It's going to increase access to primary health care. It's going to reduce health care costs. We have medically underserved areas and health care provider shortage areas in every area of New York State. I have in the proposal, if you look through the set of the pages, references to the research that proves that this does reduce cost. We are paid at a discount, so every time a patient accesses nurse practitioner care, be it through Medicaid, Medicare, or private insurance, either the taxpayer or the consumer sees a saving. In addition, there will be improved outcomes and diminished delay in treatment, and that will lead to an increase of quality of care. I've also included in the proposal some references to quality studies, and early this morning I emailed a whole bunch more to Bill, and I can email those out to the rest of us. I will make mention that this group of providers, the nurse practitioner, has existed in the United States since 1965,
and has been the subject of scrutiny and research since 1971. So that's 40 years worth of research. Additionally, we will see an increase in Medicaid and health care efficiency with fewer visits to providers, with increased screening and immunization rates, and more timely submission of reports from labs and diagnostic groups to providers. And additionally, it improves the healthcare infrastructure and builds capacity in our state. We're already starting to see the effects of the Affordable Care Act with increased numbers of patients going on to health insurance rolls. That's only going to get, slowly going to increase over time. We're also seeing the decrease in numbers of medical school graduates going into primary care, yet in the state of New York alone, we have an increase of primary care providers in the form of the nurse practitioner of 900 per year. One thing that I haven't mentioned up until now is the Medicare interpretation of collaborative practice, and I'll be very happy to email that out to everybody. I did bring it with me. I only have one copy, so I'll email it to all of you later. But just for the sake of the conversation, Medicare has addressed collaborative practice. And what Medicare says, and this is the federal government, so this is a federal recommendation, Medicare says that, yes, every provider should collaborate, including physicians, including midwives, including nurse practitioners, including assistants. However, collaboration should be voluntary. So the spirit of our legislation is to bring New York State into line with the federal government, because at the present time, we are functioning in a more onerous and burdensome model than the federal government is. Additionally, this proposal has been is endorsed by the Institute of Medicine report and through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, through the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, studies done by the RAND Corporation and Kaiser. And just to conclude, there are 19 other states presently, more than one-third of the country. The states are listed in the proposal that already have autonomous practice or do not have a collaborative practice requirement for nurse practitioners. I really do want to emphasize that collaboration is not going away. The spirit of collaboration remains. The piece of paper goes away. And finally, just to conclude, with regard to the letter of concern from the Medical Society of the State of New York, we have, at the Nurse Practitioner Association, collected letters from physicians currently licensed in the state of New York who voice their belief that the collaborative practice agreement requirement is unnecessary and support its elimination from the Nurse Practice Act. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Joy. And Bob, do you want to say something for the record? Or, again, we don't want to get back and forth, but you know, because we've...
If somebody else wants to speak first, I can grab it.
Okay. Is there any questions or comments? Yes.
My children and I use a nurse practitioner. We love her. If we lost her because her collaborating doctor was not available, we would be very unhappy.
Thank you. Tim.
I actually have a question about how New York State looks at the oversight of both physicians and nurse practitioners. I understand that there's the boards that are set up through the State Education Department, but the State Department of Health has an Office of Professional Medical Conduct, which, as I understand it, oversees patient safety or conduct issues among physicians. Are NPs covered by the Office of Professional Medical Conduct within the Department of Health?
No,
right.
No. NPs fall under the nursing board, and they fall under
which
the
is part of state
process of the Office of the Professions.
Right, which are all under state ed.
Yes.
I just want to understand how this plays out. So the Department of Health jurisdiction, if you will, or whatever you want to call it, over physicians is through the office, the OPMC, the Office of Professional Medical Conduct, but that doesn't also extend to nurse practitioners. Right.
Nurse practitioners, should they need to be disciplined, are that is taken care of by the State Ed Department, which functions as the Board of Nursing. nurse practitioner is a part of nursing.
Right, because the state department also has a state board for medicine, which oversees physicians. So I just want to understand how the agency...
In actuality, it's the Board of Regents. It's
right.
The Board of Regents,
right.
Ultimately. The determinations of the nursing board or the medical board, frankly, are all recommendations. It's the Board of Regents that reacts to those recommendations, and many times they'll change the recommendation with respect to the act of discipline or the penalty for discipline, but it is the Board of Regents. The boards for the profession under 6509 of the education law only have one authoritative power, and that's to select the examination for the profession. Everything else is advisory.
Right. No, I understand. And this is my last question related to this. Does the existence of the collaborative agreement requirement between physicians and nurse practitioners somehow bring the nurse practitioners into the authority of the Department of Health because the Department of Health oversees the conduct, if you will, of physicians?
I don't believe so. I don't want to misspeak. I think we better fact-check that to get back to you definitively. I'll get an answer, but I don't believe so.
During my tenure at SED, it was not the case, and my recent reading of the law is it's not the case now.
Okay, any other than Bob, yeah.
Okay.
For the record.
For the record. Again, not to beat the horse we beat to death last night or yesterday. And I do say that you're 100% right that we have seen very negative and protectionist on this issue. We do have some suggestions that we will be bringing forward, which we feel will have cost savings for the Medicaid program and for the state as a whole. For instance, engaging EMTs to perform services in the emergency department setting could provide significant cost savings, and we can bring things like that forward. But, you know, as much as is said in one thing, we could bring data forward that could refute everything that's been claimed. And you're going to get into a huge battle between, you know, peer reviewed, not peer reviewed, you know, is it that, is that. I have some things here, and I'll be happy to submit them. But in a few of them, for instance, if you take a map of advanced practice nurses and physicians, they directly overlap as to where they're practicing. So they're not serving in underserved areas, unless Gardenfield is underserved. But if you also, the liability rates have been increasing at a rate of 15% to 20% for nurse practitioners in the last 3 years that we have records for. So from a quality and safety point of view, I could theoretically argue that since our rates have been only going up by a couple of percent, maybe that means something. But we all realize what liability numbers are. But there's data out there that could be argued in both ways. I do have a statement from ACP, which I think sums it up very nicely. And this was from 2009. And it says, the ACP advocates for research efforts to identify and disseminate effective models of collaboration, referral, and co-management of patients between and among nurse practitioners and physicians, which I think suggests that there really is research needed on this matter. And I, again, would ask that we be very cautious before we enact recommendations without adequate research. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
Well, actually, our time is up for that category.
Oh, really? Okay. I'm going to have some discretion here maybe a little bit because I see two more, right, David? And three?
One moment.
Three more. David?
I just want to make a brief comment about the maps that were just shown. It's kind of irrelevant. Your map shows density with this population. That doesn't mean that physicians don't serve in an underserved area or NPs
right.
or PAs.
All right. So this is the kind of stuff we don't want to get into now because obviously a map and so on. But of substance, a little different. Catherine?
I wanted to ask two questions. One is that is there something, in addition to the collaborative agreement, is there something that is like a backup agreement with a hospital or like a health center has a backup arrangement with another level of care? Does would a nurse practitioner practice have some kind of like backup agreement like that?
That would be, are you saying in the perfect world where this requirement was eliminated, yes, the nurse practitioner, just like a physician, just like a midwife, just like any other autonomous licensed healthcare provider, would have the good sense and the ethics
right.
to have coverage,
right.
To have consulting and referring arrangements in place,
And in fact, what the Medicare recommendation is that while collaboration is voluntary, the nurse practitioner must be able to, if they were to arrive at your doorstep, must be able to furnish the name of the physician who she or he collaborates with, and they would make phone calls and say, yes, do you collaborate with Joy Elwell? And the physician would say, yes, because if they said no, then I would be in big time trouble. And I did want to make a comment about the map. I'm sorry, but I have to. The map shows where we're at today because of the collaborative practice agreement. With the collaborative practice agreement goes away, it frees nurse practitioners to open their practices. And we're constrained right now to opening practices where we can find physicians who collaborate with us.
Okay. Moira, you have the last word on this.
I had a second question.
Brooklyn and the Bronx are definitely underserved on that map.
Catherine, yeah, last word.
We're talking about evidence and research. If there are 19 other states, is there something that distills what the experience has been and what's known? Is that's not there?
Yeah, there are. That doesn't solve the problem of interpreting the data and so forth. But, one might say there's a lot of evidence.
Okay. And in terms of sort of the underservedness, we have had to rely on nurse practitioners to actually go out into the homes. I know that there are more physicians that are doing home visits now. That's a really great trend. But nurse practitioners go out to vulnerable and homebound patients in an important way.
Right. Okay. So let's just leave it there. And again, we may have to come back to some of these in the final accounting. Let's move on to thank you very much, Joy, and everyone else for those comments. Tina, 53. Tina? Is your mic on?
No. It's number 53, certified registered nurse anesthetist scope of practice. Currently, nurse anesthetists, the only place you will find them in New York State regulation is in the 405 code. New York State relaxed any formal recognition and uniform standards for the practice of nurse anesthesia. You all can read there. The benefits of the proposal are that CRNAs alone is the most cost-effective anesthesia delivery model, and it's the only model that generates net revenue for hospitals. This is because most nurse anesthetists are hospital employees, so that there isn't additional charges for their services. It allows hospitals the flexibility to transform patient care in a manner that is consistent with current state and federal reform initiatives to address the healthcare workforce shortage. It also enables the facilities in medically underserved areas to offer surgical, obstetrical, trauma stabilization, and pain management to vulnerable populations, including those in hospitals and impoverished urban centers, critical access hospitals in rural areas, and regions with limited supply of specialized providers. The impact on quality, CRNAs, there are, again, citations here, that provide high-quality, cost-effective, safe anesthesia care to all the patients they serve. They practice in every setting, and there's research data that shows that there's no difference in the quality of care or patient outcomes when anesthesia services are provided by CRNAs, anesthesiologists, or CRNAs supervised by physicians. In terms of the impact on Medicaid costs and efficiency, it would fall into cost containment, again, as it would minimize redundancy and maximization of the federal dollars through the alignment of New York policies with Medicare, most of the managed care and public and private health plans. And there are currently 38 state Medicaid programs that directly reimburse for CRNA services. And again, the cost reduction would be because CRNAs are generally salaried and their compensation is less than anesthesiologists, and they often receive no overtime pay, but will provide the same identical set of anesthesia services. Again, it would be administrative action. It could be, and we have the language related to that.
We have the proposal, and you can look at the exact language. Questions and comments? By the way, my strategy with the presentation was kind of get through the easiest ones first and at least get a little stuff under our belt. But anyway, we're here. We're getting close. Bob.
recognizing your charge yesterday that I need to come with positive ideas. We would like to consider bringing forward a proposal to develop a program for anesthesia assistance, which may significantly improve costs in this regard. I do have for submission to the chair, 10 documents that I will be forwarding that claim that provision of nurse anesthetist care is not cost effective and is not necessarily quality effective. And so I will be submitting those documents for your review. But the brief, I do want to be brief, I swear. I just want to give one statistic, which I think is very pertinent to this organization right here. Texas Medicaid studies, cost of labor, anesthesia, analgesia billed to the Texas Medicaid 19% to 26% less per patient when provided by an anesthesiologist, despite the lower per unit reimbursement for nurse anesthetists in that state. In this state, there is no lower reimbursement. The reimbursement is the same. So the cost savings could be even greater to New York State by better use utilization of anesthesiologists.
Okay. In terms of the additional proposal, you should send that through. I mean, so this is the first time we've been seeing about it. It's not going to obviously be included in the scoring. Let's just get all these other, let's call them in the bullpen, I guess, or whatever the right term is. We'll have to see how we can deal with those in terms of the time of our committee. But I do appreciate putting forward a positive agenda. That's good because it's, again, trying not to get back and forth with the data because there's no really need to do that. We've been through this. You see the problem, you know, the pattern that we have with the number of the proposals that go back and forth, and we're not going to be able to cut through that here. So, you know, just keep that in mind and keeping that, you know, that thought in mind. Any other questions or comments? Joy.
I'm just going to most respectfully and very briefly speak in favor of this. We are charged. The name of our mission is workforce flexibility. We already have these providers. We've had nurse, certified registered nurse anesthetists, the oldest provider of anesthesia in this country, and they're not defined in the law, and that is a problem. So what we end up with is institutional licensure, something that nobody wants. If we codify these folks in law, we protect public safety, and we increase access to care. Thank you.
Any other comments? Okay. Moving on to Hen. Oh, yes.
Currently, certified nurse anesthetists, what they can do in a is determined by the institution that they're working for?
Yes, because they are only recognized in the 405 yes. regulations, which are the regulations that oversee hospitals.
Thank you.
Bob Reed represents the anesthesiologist. It's a supervisory role. It's determined by the supervisor.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Bob Reed is represented by the supervisory role of the anesthesiologist. That's who determines the role.
Right. Okay. Henry, you've been very patient. I know you've had I really appreciate your history of it with state ed and so on has been very helpful here because I can't figure out what the heck's going on with some of these. But you want to propose something representing Commissioner Hogan on the social work licensing laws?
Exactly. Thank you so much, Bill.
This is number 84.
Number 84. I shared it with all of you just a little while ago. We've had some discussion. Commissioner Hogan made four recommendations. After a lot of discussion, we realized three of them are probably more long-term. But this one has some immediacy, and that's, you know, thinking back to the initial discussion about how we're going to be looking at what is probative, what is valuable, what might we be able to do today that will have significant impact, and more importantly, how will it impact on the Medicaid redesign team's other goals. The one that we're proposing here just struck us as critically important to this discussion. Because of the four issues that were raised earlier about cost, quality, efficiency, and overall impact. Most of you will be shocked to learn that up until the 21st century, psychology was not a profession in New York. It was there was title protection in the education law, and in 2002, many of the behavioral health professions were in fact expanded, changed, modified in psychology. For one, you finally got a scope of practice, a definition in terms of who they are, not just some fancy schmancy title. Social work was expanded in a lot of ways. Mental health practitioners came out, And many of, and the legislature in its wisdom realized, though, there was a problem with this regulation of these.
I just want to make sure you passed out the proposal.
Yes, I did.
Okay, great.
You guys ended up short.
Oh, okay.
You're short on, I shorted you on your side, I'm sorry. But you have yours in the mail.
sorry for that interruption.
So the legislature, in his wisdom, realized that the way behavioral health in New York in particular had been developed in a very integrated manner, but using many, many levels of trained individuals in those professions, in social work, in psychology and so on, but not necessarily related to the new higher standards that the education department was now required to promote, created an exemption in the law. And it allowed all of the individuals, psychologists who were not at license level, CASAC, social workers, certified rehab counselors, vocational counselors, recreation therapists, mental health therapy aides who also provide case management and other kinds of things, caseworkers and peer specialists. All of these integrated, all of these other practitioners that are a key element of this integrated system and behavioral health that we have, to have an exemption from the law. That exemption was given 6 years to move out, and then it was extended for another two. We are now on the eve of that exemption sunsetting in 2013, and we're now involved in this dramatic change in terms of healthcare and how it's delivered in New York. And Commissioner Hogan, when he was looking at it, was looking at just a narrow piece of the social work person and how they would be suddenly operating independently in independent practice, but more importantly, how does this impact the MRT? One of the major proposals that the MRT has, which is very significant to the state of New York, is the one with respect to health homes. The failure to continue the exemption, at least for the next 2 years as we move to another MRT proposal, which is behavioral health organizations, is going to undermine the savings in particular with real adverse impact in terms of quality and delivery of health care. And that is why I attached a very short summary, even though I apologize, 23 pages, of a survey that we undertook with the SED of the impact of the abolition of the sunsetting of the current exemption in the law. If the exemption in the law goes into play, if the exemption sunsets, the increased cost to the Medicaid program, to New York State in terms of delivery of care, will be a minimum of what we projected over the past of at least $23 to $24 million. Probably closer to 45, but it could even be as high as $85 million. And that's why this proposal is, and our analysis of the survey is here with you as well. We know, and so does the, and so the everyone in behavioral health, that the exemption is qualitatively as high, if not higher, than the Title VII current process. And that's because we've had a long history. We created it. We moved it. In fact, we are in support of the Title VII movement in all of the professions. When we, 2 years ago, amended our clinic regulations, we have already moved our outpatient clinics to the new design of only licensed practitioners. And we did it in a controlled and in a caring way, understanding the financial consequences and understanding the evolution of those professions to be able to deliver services in all the communities that were impacted. However, there's a large array of licensed services that use many, many practitioners who are trained at collegiate levels, are trained at psychotherapy clinics, are professionals as well as lay people who have CASAC. That's the title that's used for individuals who are involved in substance abuse disorder treatment. Rehabilitate mental hygiene therapy aides, the people on our wards and so on, who and in our housing units that work directly with clients who deal with de-escalation techniques. Large numbers of individuals who do case management. For those of you who are here who are going to be surprised to hear that case management is a restricted practice, at least that's what state ed has been telling me. I'm not quite sure I agree with them, but if that's the case, what's going to happen with health homes is going to be very, very difficult for all of us. So I would be very, very concerned. The survey talked about, it's about page 7, you'll see the services that they identified, they being SED, that they did not move on, that they feel are restricted and unrestricted. And you'll see also the other, on page 5 through 7, the various elements of people's work. This survey was given to the world. There was a Survey Monkey put on the SED website, and OMH is not the only agency. DOCS, OPWDD, many other agencies also have this exemption. And providers were allowed to provide information concerning their workforce. And based on that, we and SED have kind of come to agreement that these are the ramifications. This is our analysis. This is going to be going on the SED website in the next week. The implications are really quite serious. Now, it's not the end of the world. That doesn't mean that we do not want to see this movement. We are moving the system to one in which we're relying more and more on Title VII licenses. But we don't want to lose the efforts that we made, including diversifying the workforce. By and large, we found that most of the employees who would be affected by this would be diversity employees. We would be really compromising our ability to deliver services in areas, particularly in the state where we're most needed, which is down in the New York City area. So the underlying purpose of this is say cost is definitely a factor. It's a cost-effective process. It's going to modify over time, and there's another MRT proposal which is going to help shape that to move us into a glide path to the ultimately the elimination of the exemption, which we call the Behavioral Health Organization. Within 3 years, all of behavioral health will be integrated with primary care, and we're going to be in some kind of a managed care system. And that's pretty concrete right now. The Office of Mental Health is working very, very diligently to move that along. We've selected 5 new behavioral health organizations to help monitor that system. And health homes would be substantially compromised if this exemption were not to continue. Quality has been demonstrated repeatedly. Efficiency in terms of delivering services is very, very clear. This is not a public program alone. The majority of these employees are not-for-profits around the state. And then lastly, the overall impact is severe either way one looks at it. So with that as kind of, forgive me for taking perhaps a little more time than I even wanted, but I'd be more than glad to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Questions or comments? Yes, Audrey.
I'm sorry, I'm sure it's me and the fact that it's after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but in one sentence, what is the exemption for?
The exemption is to provide services in OMH licensed and regulated programs that are otherwise restricted to certain Title VII professions, social work, mental health practitioners, and psychology in particular, those professions specifically.
So other than the exemption provides for staff who have other training than those 7 professions to provide those services.
Right. People who have historically been providing those services because they were, you know, we created these titles under civil service requirements and that type of thing.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, Maura.
So this would also affect the Health and Hospitals Corporation?
Oh, sure. To the extent that you have an Article 31 clinic, yeah.
Yeah, so we represent thousands of both the licensed social workers and the other titles that are not licensed providing this care. And although Lauren Johnson is not here from HHC, I'm sure that she agrees we can't afford to move everybody up to the licensed salary, nor can we afford to have any more layoffs as a result of not dealing with this exemption language. Thank you.
Yes, Joy.
I would just add that it is estimated that mental illness affects 25%. I said that 25% of the population. The average waiting time for a prescribing psychiatric visit in the state has been estimated at 6 months. We need as many mental health providers as possible to address the expanding need for psychiatric and mental health as possible. So, thanks.
Great, thank you. Any other comments?
Yes,
and here. Brian?
I just have a question. I want to be sure. At one point, you say the proposal could affect additional programs licensed, funded, or regulated by other state agencies.
I'm sorry, I can't.
Sorry. By other state agencies such as OPWDD, OCFS, OASIS, Corrections, and others. Would this proposal do that, or under this proposal, if we...
The data I provided you only relates to the OMH programs. Each of those other agencies has done similar analyses, and so the I only gave you the behavioral health impact in terms of our agency. To the extent that OPWDD would be impacted, they also have many psychologists and social workers who would be impacted by this as well. In DOCS, there are behavioral health kinds of clinics in that situation. They've been asked to respond as well. And all the agencies have been moving these many several years toward full licensure. But the real question has been the timing.
Yeah, I have just two questions. As I recall, part of the purpose of the exemption relates to the form of organization of the work site, and it was to not only grandfather people who may or may not have had the right professional licensure and are hopefully working towards it, but also some of their employers needed time to restructure their corporate nature. Am I remembering that right?
That's correct. It's directly related to only those entities that are either regulated or licensed by the requisite agency.
And what I don't recall is, and you know, I chair health, not mental health or higher ed. Why mental hygiene was not in this paragraph to begin with. Do you know why?
I'm sorry, in what
paragraph? In other words, the paragraph that you're proposing to amend here, where you're going to proposing to add Department of Mental Hygiene.
No, that's the old legislation, and it's already in there. That we just gave you what the law looks like now. That includes the Department of Mental Hygiene, of which the Office of Mental Health, the Office of Professional, the Office of People with Developmental Disabilities is part of. Okay.
So the proposed change is just extending the sunset a year? I'm not following.
Yes, the proposal would be to extend the extension the exemption for a reasonable time, not yet to be determined, maybe periodic reviews as to whether or not the exemption would be appropriate. We have not. This is something that the governor's office will be negotiating at some point, I would suspect. But at this point, it would have to extend. Right now, the legislature has extended once for a two-year period.
Wait, but what's on page 2 with A there is what's currently in the statute, correct?
That's what's currently in the
statute.
And
what you're looking to do is basically eliminate that part at the end that says when the exemption ends.
That's correct.
Excuse me, this is the Department of Labor on the phone. Does this also apply to the public school system and social services providers?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
Sorry, I'll move closer. Does this also apply to the public school system and social services that are provided through that venue?
It does apply to certain local government units. It might apply to local counties, and it may, in fact, involve some of the local school districts.
Okay. Thank you.
Bill Stack. On first page, under proposal description, it indicates establish a permanent
exemption. Is it for a couple of years or permanent?
Well, at this point, we think it's going to die anyway. And I'll tell you why it's going to die. I think a lot of what the need for the exemption will die because as we move toward a managed care environment, increasingly the managed care industry will start dictating what kinds of providers can provide what kinds of services. It may well be whether it's they will determine which providers are going to be in and which ones aren't going to be in, what kinds of standards they're going to expect, what kinds of experience.
But, what do you want this proposal to say for this group? In other words, it's, what's the concrete ask?
The concrete ask is to eliminate the repeal date to 2000, the sunset provision, and to continue the exemption
for how long?
For an indeterminate time at this point.
Okay, Bob.
I think to make everybody happier, if there was a fixed point, do you feel 3 years from now would be appropriate?
I think in 3 years we're going to have a better handle in terms of where we are because but I would suggest that to keep it on such a short leash would not be ideal. The ideal is were it not to be extended permanently until such time as it were not needed, we would expect that a 5-year period. Internally we've looked at it and we think at least the next 5 years or so is going to be required because we know that what's going to happen with DHOs is going to take at least another we're just moving into that arena in managed care over the next 2 years, and then it'll take another 2 years for the dust to settle at that point.
But this is a proposal, so you have to be exact about what we want, you're proposing, I would seem to me. And Tina?
I understand conceptually everything that you're asking for, but why don't you want to just repeal the sunset provision? I don't understand why you want to extend it or put in a time frame. I mean, and maybe there's a specific reason why you're asking.
It's
just not clear to me why.
In part because we've been supportive of the legislative goals, which has been to enhance the credentials and enhance the training of practitioners in the field. We just know that the institutions and the economic consequences of that are not prime at this point in time. We do know that our system is a value-laden system and can, in fact, provide all of the requisite protections. I think that over time it will do that. I have not come forward at this point. What we were asking was for a elimination of the sunset and a continuation of the exemption, and at some point in the future we anticipate that it'll no longer be necessary.
Okay, a few more comments. And how about just these last two, Catherine and Moira, and then because we have to move on.
In order to promote stability in the job market and to encourage people to go into these fields and not feel like they're going to be at risk 3 years down the road, we would support repealing the sunset provision.
I think that there's a real problem with having a short time frame on this. This requirement is something that is going to cause enormous disruption in the community-based sector. And to the point that somehow managed care is going to make this issue go away, I just want to refer to experiences in managed long-term care and other parts of managed care where there were things that plans wanted to do, and the answer back was, no, there is some rule about what flavor of provider and what structure of supervision needs to happen that exists regardless of the fact that you have a little bit more flexibility in how you spend the money. So the idea that managed care makes the rules go away, I really question that.
All right, so those are very good points. So maybe you'll consider that when you make your proposal and concretely there. So we have one more formal proposal. I want to commend everyone for still being here. I know it's a long day, but we have one more formal proposal and then some other, let's call it housekeeping or looking forward. But this is a proposal from the Podiatric Medical Association. Are the folks from the association still here? They were bright here, bright and early in the morning, but because they're not a member of the MRT or this task force, they submitted a proposal. I'm going to read only like the first paragraph You know, it has some similar issues and problems of things that have come up before, but it was submitted by the general public. They have a full proposal, which will be on the slate, and it can be surveyed as well. I'm just going to read it, open it up for comments, and again, it has some of the same thematic issues that we've seen in some of the proposals. So this is a proposal to expand the definition of the practice of podiatry. The proposal expands the definition of the practice of podiatry to include, in addition to the treatment of the foot, conditions of the ankle, and all other and all soft tissue structures related to the ankle that go up to the leg. Expanding the scope of podiatric practice in New York will bring it more in line with the vast majority of other states in the country, which already allow the scope of practice to include the treatment of the ankle and soft tissue areas associated with the ankle, in addition to the structures of the foot. New York is one of the only six states that restrict the treatment of the foot. So that's, you know, you should have a copy of this. It will be one of the ones submitted, and, you know, I'm not going to do anything more than read that. And so any questions or comments on this particular proposal?
Just my usual.
Yeah, rightly so. Okay. No, and I appreciate that. For the record. Ditto. Okay. Okay, so this will be, you know, one of the ones that will be scored. So just want to move now to a – there were a number of proposals that we really didn't get to on our subcommittee because we had really – a lot to do, and there was sort of no champion and no specific proposal presented at the subgroups, and none have come through, you know, through these other channels. So, but one in particular, number 25, which relates to LPN assessments, I just want to bring that up because, it was part of our original charge. So that at least needs to be addressed. So I want to just mention that. So there was a proposal in the original charge to allow LPNs to conduct assessments in long-term care settings. And again, if, you know, there was no one to present the proposal, and I'm not really sure, you know, how it originated, and it may be important or not. But so for the moment now, we're not addressing it, but if there's somebody here who represents that, you know, that proposal and would like to do something, either say something now, or if there is, again, since we are still we're not encouraging them, but we don't want to close off any proposals that might come through, and we'll see how we'll have to deal with them, you know, down the road. But I just want to, you know, is there any comments about to allow LPNs to conduct assessment in long-term care settings proposal? Yes, Steve.
The Nurses Association opposes that proposal because there is absolutely no education at the LPN level related to assessment whatsoever at all. The LPN educators have issues. They don't feel that they have the curriculum to do that at the level, and we would not support
right.
that.
Again, the reason one of the reasons I was sort of pushing that we actually have proposals is that instead of it just being a phrase, you know, we would actually have something a little bit more substance to respond to. But anyone else want to speak to that now? Yes.
I think at first blush it seems like a great idea. I also think it ties in many of the proposals that have been brought forth here, such as career ladders, and I think that there's some value to this in many different ways.
So, Joy?
I'm just going to speak in support of, well, actually, I'm going to speak in opposition. So, speaking in support of Tina, but I'm going to speak in opposition to this because I'm not unfamiliar, or I should say I am familiar with the curricula of registered nurse and licensed practical nursing education programs. And Tina is correct. There is nothing about assessments in LPN curriculum. So to give this responsibility to someone who has not had the didactic or clinical education in how to do it is just not going to work. They have to be prepared. So it would mean a whole change. And there's nobody here to champion it either.
Right, well, there's no one here to speak for it. So, all right, any other comments? And again, if there are any of the other proposals that came in that, you know, because there was no proposal or champion, we may have had a phrase or something like that, we didn't really move forward on. If there's anyone, you know, on this work committee who wants to bring those up, they should. You know, they can send an email, and we'll begin to see how we might incorporate that into whatever it is we can do, if it's at all possible. But again, I want to be as inclusive as I can be until for as long as I can be. Okay. Yes.
So moving on. Yeah, this is Debbie King. I think that in our group we did look at that, but there wasn't any proposal for how to expand the education, et cetera. So it was just the general, and we thought that this was something that at the very disposal week would have to be a long-term issue, could not be a short-term issue.
Okay, so it's a long-term. Debbie, weren't you here before? Now you're there? That doesn't surprise me. Anyway, okay, well, okay,
can I just make one comment regarding going back to one of the non-skilled proposals?
Yes.
They combined two of the proposals, one being the advanced certification for MedTech, and there was another proposal that was to expand the scope of CNAs for simple dressings or applying Medicaid ointments. The med tech would require, in my opinion, an advanced certification, but the other issues I don't think would require an advanced certification. They would just require competency testing and additional training.
Yeah, yes. Audrey.
Just to clarify, they weren't combined. I referenced the med tech one, but they were not combined.
Okay, so
they were standalone.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. I think we've concluded the proposal presentations, and we've had some discussion, limited discussion about them, but it's a lot of ground. So our next, I guess the next step is we want to get out the survey tomorrow. If, for those people who have made proposals, take into consideration what they've heard today and comments that are made and either acknowledge to the Department of Health that the proposal that you sent is the one. If nothing is heard, the one that is there will be sent out. If there are changes, you know, small changes, tweaking you want to make based on anything you've heard today, any address, you know, you should do that. Send it in. Whatever we have at that time, knowing that these are, again, still drafts, we hope that through various, you know, further discussions, they still may be tweaked until the very day we get them in, and even beyond that, between the period we recommend them and they've really brought forth before the full MRT, all of that we can continue to massage, tweak, or do, you know, improve whatever our overall slate of presentation will be. So, yes, Brian.
Where should we send them if we want to tweak them?
To the MRT. Well, where should they send them?
Yes, the MRT, BML, the MRT, you know, the MRT workforce at health.state.ny.us.
I have so many proposals. I get CC'd on a lot of them, and believe me, I can't. I'm surprised I'm still sitting here. Anyway, okay, so that's the next.
And if I could suggest, too, with any new proposals, I know like 71, you know, if we could put a time frame on that because we're running out of time. So, you know, obviously we're not going to get in the Delphi instrument, but maybe by the 3rd at the latest for any final proposals, because otherwise we're not going to be able to get them before
this
group.
Okay, great. So, you know, any new proposal, right. So there was the dental hygienist one, and there was yours, Bill?
I'd just like to suggest to our colleagues at the health department to perhaps disseminate later today some standardized naming procedure for the electronic name, the document name of what's coming in, because there was I found myself having to rename everything when I was saving it, and if there could be some standardized approach, perhaps with a date on it, that would be helpful.
Okay, great. All right, so we actually already had a discussion adoption of the charge. Oh, that means we're ahead of time. And we break, so we're going to complete the prioritization surveys. We're going to be sending those out, and they'll have, it'll all have the directions about how many, you know, how much time you have to send it back and how to fill it out and so on. And then that will then be an added piece of information when we consider the proposals on the 7th. Does that do it?
Just
Just one quick point of clarification. We did check with our Office of Counsel regarding the nurse practitioner collaboration issue, that question that Tim had, and no, the department has no involvement irrespective of that collaborative agreement.
So, again, my thank you all very much for participating in this, and I'm sure we'll all be in touch.
Bill, just a quick reminder. The next meeting is same location. It will be right here, 10 to 3:30 on the 7th.
Great. Okay. And so thank you all very much. Bye-bye.
You don't do it down. It's cool like that. The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your lines have been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.